Thank you.
Okay, it's August 5th, 2010. We're at the offices of the New York Fed in New York. My name's Chris Seifer. The rest of us are all with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act 2009. It tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis. That statute tells us to look at certain things, including institutions that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. Lehman falls into the former. Wachovia almost fell into the latter. And tells us to look at, you know, a lot of other issues in terms of leverage growth, derivatives, you know, all that kind of fun stuff. And it tells us specifically to look at the issue of too big to fail. So that's why we asked to talk to the New York Fed and specifically the folks that were involved in Lehman and Wachovia and could help us understand those two institutions and bank supervision in the context of too big to fail in general, systemically important institutions. So before we went on the record, Sherry was mentioning that it would probably be a good idea to let Mr. Rutledge sort of address that generally and to possibly clarify some remarks we heard from Mr. Cole. I think it was earlier this week or last week. I'm losing track. So with that, why don't we start?
Okay. So is the hookup set up with Caperton? You want me to wait? Or
he's not on yet. He's going to join in a few minutes.
Maybe in the interest of time, yeah. I should just start, though.
Yeah, I think okay. So, since we're limited on time.
Okay. What I thought I would do, Chris, is just give you a very quick structural snapshot of Federal Reserve Bank of New York responsibilities regarding particularly Lehman and Wachovia.
And then, I'm sorry, this is the only one that's working, so I'm going to need to dial this.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Don't let me distract you.
No. Having five people swarming around in front of me is not a distraction. So in terms of Lehman, for benefit of the people who may have just joined by a conference call, this is Bill Rutledge, who is head of bank supervision here at the New York Fed, who is leading off with a few brief comments structurally that are relevant to a discussion of Lehman and Wachovia, as well as the broader discussion of systemically important institutions. Beginning first with Lehman. As I think you all probably know, but just to state clearly up front, the Federal Reserve had no supervisory relationship with Lehman, full stop. Lehman was supervised on a consolidated basis by the SEC pursuant to the CSE regime that it put in place a few years earlier. The SEC also supervised the broker-dealer of Lehman. There were some pieces of the Lehman organization that were subject to bank supervision, in particular an industrial loan company that was supervised by the FDIC. So the Fed, no responsibility either at the consolidated level or any of the individual entities for Lehman. With the situation involving Bayer in the spring and the beginning of the PDCF program, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York set up a monitoring operation outside of bank supervision, albeit with a number of bank supervision people playing prominent roles in carrying out that monitoring effort. And the gentleman to my right, Art Angelo, was designated as the head of that monitoring unit respecting the investment banks, including Lehman, that were making use of the PDCF facilities. And we can get into more detail later as to what that all entailed. Respecting Wachovia, let me just say a few words about the Federal Reserve System's organization of supervisory responsibilities, particularly for the major firms. A core element of the Federal Reserve's supervisory approach is to designate a so-called responsible reserve bank. That's typically the reserve bank in whose district a particular bank holding company or bank is headquartered, has most of its assets and operations. So for the major firms, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is the responsible reserve bank for Citigroup, for J.P. Morgan Chase, for Bank of New York, and now for Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs after they became bank holding companies. In similar vein, the Richmond Fed was the responsible reserve bank for Wachovia, and the San Francisco Reserve Bank was the responsible reserve bank for Wells. The responsible reserve bank carries out supervisory efforts on behalf of the Board of Governors regarding the institutions it's been delegated responsibility to oversee, but we are in turn overseen by the board staff and the governors. So the board staff and the governors would have something of a bilateral.
Dave Caperton joining.
Hey, Dave, this is Bill Rutledge. I was beginning with just a very quick description of some structural elements regarding supervision.
Please don't let me interrupt.
So,
too late.
So, the Board of Governors and its staff oversee how the responsible reserve banks carry out their missions. But we also, beyond that bilateral relationship between the board staff and the responsible reserve bank, have created structures over the years to be more effective in coordinating supervision and ensuring consistency and effectiveness of supervision. And the structure, I'm going to talk in terms of the 2008 structure, because I think that's the period that you're most interested in. There were some changes some years earlier, some changes later. I'm going to focus on 2008. At that point in time, there was a committee that was chaired by Roger Cole called the Supervision Committee, so we call it the SC. All of the heads of supervision of the respective reserve banks are on that committee. So you got the 12 soup heads, as we call them, on the same committee as chaired by Roger, with Sandy Bronstein, the head of DCCA as board staff, also essentially co-chairing with Roger. That's kind of the parent committee. And then, somewhat to your question, Chris, up front, under that parent committee, there are subdivisions or subcommittees that are built around relatively similar portfolios. So reporting to the SC would be something that was called the LCBOMG, or the Large Commercial Banking Organization Management Group. That was chaired by Deborah Bailey. There was a regional banking management group. There was a community management group. There was an FBO management group. So as you can see, just cuts by basically the nature of the entities within those portfolios.
FBO being foreign banking organization.
Thank you. So, yeah, please interrupt if there are some acronyms that we swing through. So
we are known for our
Everybody is. I'm going to focus primarily on the LCBO, because that's clearly your area of major interest. That was a structure that was set up a few years earlier and had maybe 20 or more firms that were covered within it. Under the LCBOMG, we created about 5 years ago an operating arm or subcommittee of the subcommittee called the Large Financial Institution Committee. We took about a dozen or so firms from the broader population of the LCBOs to treat as large financial institutions under an approach that would be particularly intense in terms of vetting supervisory plans, discussing emerging issues, vetting ratings, talking about enforcement actions, a broad set of very hands-on elements of the supervisory process to be carried out by the Large Financial Institutions Committee that was chaired by a New York Fed person, Sarah Dahlgren. And then later in 2008, when Sarah's responsibilities changed, it became chaired by Art. So you had the LCBOMG chaired by the board staff and the operating arm, the LFIC, chaired by the New York Fed. The there are other elements of structure we can get into in more detail later, but we basically wanted key risk people to also be heavily engaged at the LFIC level. So the New York Fed head of risk, Brian Peters, the board staff head of risk, John Greenlee, were also key parts of the LFIC structure. The determination of which entities were LCBOs and then which of the LCBOs were determined to be LFICs, or LFIs, was a process that heavily focused on size of operation, how involved they were in various complex business lines, what complexity there was generally about their range of activities. So it was heavily driven in the determination of the LFIs by determining what set of institutions would be particularly important that you had a system-wide look to be able to dig into their size and complexity of operations. So it wasn't a determination of systemic importance per se, although obviously there's a strong correlation if you're looking at large institutions that are big players in complex markets. There's a correlation with systemic importance, but the driver was very much how can you supervise, or what firms do you need to work together to get insights in order to supervise most effectively. And one of the implicit reasons for creating the structure in this way was that if you look at the responsible reserve banks, going back to that terminology I started with, some reserve banks only had one or two major institutions. So by having this system-wide group come together, they'd have the benefit of hearing emerging risks and other issues coming up across the overall portfolio. The LFIC did not have decision-making power. It did not determine what ratings were or what enforcement action should be, but it was a mechanism to have a very fulsome vetting of what each individual reserve bank was intending to do or concluding or planning in the supervisory process, and then vetting it among peers and board staff, which is also involved in the LFIC, but then ultimately the responsibility for ratings and follow-up actions went back to the responsible reserve bank, subject to the oversight in that bilateral relationship with the board and its staff.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. So let me ask you something that goes a little further than that. What we'd like, what I'd at least like to try to get a better understanding of is within that structure then, and I take it that most of the banks in the LFIC were probably New York-based banks. Obviously, you've got, you know, Wachovia down in Richmond and Wells out in San Francisco, but I take most of the others were New York.
It was the majority, sorry.
Right. Okay. Is how you guys supervise those banks, and in particularly from the issue of systemic importance and systemic risk, and maybe this will help. I mean, one of the things we have seen in the documents in terms of, you know, the decisions that were made or not made on Lehman and the decisions that were made on Wachovia is the clear focus on, for example, the Richmond Fed memo on Wachovia was, if we let this bank fail in the typical liquidation lease cost resolution way, a bunch of uninsured creditors are going to take hits, and that has implications. In addition to that, there's implications to confidence in the U.S. banking system in general. In addition to that, there's implications on the general economy, not only the U.S. economy, but the international economy, because Wachovia had business relationships out there. And the same thing with Lehman. You know, when we're looking at the documents leading up to and including that September weekend, you know, there's, of course, a lot of focus on who are Lehman's counterparties and what are going to be the impacts of a Lehman bankruptcy. So we're wondering, you know, what the New York Fed and other bank supervisors that we've talked to, you know, do differently, if anything, for these types of institutions that, God forbid, when they do get in trouble, you have to make those determinations and look at the systemic implications.
Okay. I'm going to answer in two parts. The first is how our overall structure in bank supervision work, particularly regarding the major firms, and then segueing in to some of the work that we did on a more bank-wide basis beginning maybe 2005 that I think prepared us for helping to make some of the judgments that you ended with in your comments, Chris.
Okay.
So in terms of our broad supervisory approach, our business model, which we put in place in the year 2000, was to have specialists by institution and specialists by risk stripe. So Art's current position is head of the relationship or institutional side. At that time, Sarah Dahlgren was in charge of the institutional or relationship side. Within that side, we put in place teams of people who would spend 24/7 at individual large institutions. We're designating the lead of such team as a central point of contact. You may have heard the CPC terminology. So we had, as part of our construct regarding the major firms, specialized people by individual institution for the major institutions who would look in supervising that firm to get a really good handle on risk issues for that firm, both in the for the individual firm and in the context of broader system-wide issues. So we would have a CPC, in effect, put claims in for credit risk examiners, market risk examiners, liquidity risk examiners, operational risk examiners, who were specialists within the risk stripe to come in and do critical reviews. Those risk examiners would have the benefit of breadth of access to firms to have a very good handle on how risks were changing over time. We also had a financial sector policy and analysis area, which actually Art was in charge of earlier in 08-07, which was charged with staying on top of issues from a broader financial sector perspective that could be factors in making assessments of the individual firms. In the course, and this I'm kind of transferring into the second part of my answer, and in the course of, let's say, 2005-06-07, we began to have a much more structured approach to looking at financial sector issues and vulnerabilities. So we brought together people from a number of different policy areas around the bank, our markets people, our research people, our bank soup people, to get a handle on changing market developments, emerging vulnerabilities, in order to have some perspective on what was going on more broadly in the financial sector. As we moved into the crisis period and were looking to make judgments on individual firms, we had the benefit of having brought together the several different disciplines around the bank to help give us perspective on what the markets were at that time and to be in a position to make judgments on how the markets would be affected depending on what kinds of options and in fact were chosen for dealing with problem situations, whether those problem situations involve firms that we supervised or not. Obviously, as we talked up front, we didn't supervise Lehman at all. And similarly, we did not supervise Fannie and Freddie, and we didn't supervise AIG, we didn't supervise the rest of the investment banks. But there was all information relevant to working on judgments on implications for the broader financial sector of individual institution problems. And there was a similar effort that we coordinated with at board staff that also looked to bring together really smart people from monetary affairs, international affairs, bank soup to look at some of those broader market issues and be positioned as the crisis started to unfold to make judgments relevant to systemic risk.
So at what time, you talked about these risk stripe folk, but at what time are they gathering information from the non-Federal Reserve regulated institutions, the AIGs, the investment banks regulated?
They're not.
Okay. I misunderstood you. Just one of your recent comments, you said, even though we didn't regulate those folks.
So when the crisis unfolded, mm-hmm. We were looking at the overall financial system, inclusive of firms we didn't supervise. So we did in individual cases look during 2000 and mainly 2008, I would say, mm-hmm. at individual firms to try to gather some information about them. But we did not have the history because, implicit in your question, we didn't have the authority to send people in to review the investment banks, the AIG, GSEs, etc.
Okay. So an example of that would have been, for example, the March 08 time frame with the primary dealer credit facility and putting the monitors in that you were in charge of.
Yeah, you might want to.
Right. So that's...
Okay. Before you get there,
okay.
Sorry,
sure,
you mentioned that in the 2005 to 2007 time frame, you folks started to have a more structured approach to look at financial sector vulnerabilities. Any particular reason why that gets instituted in that time frame? Were there red flags out there that said, hey, we got to...
I think it was partly a sense of possible vulnerabilities, and Tim Geithner gave... what was the date? Do you remember the day of the speech?
I think the Hong Kong speech was September 2005-ish or 6. I'm not sure which one it was. But it was September, I remember.
But I think it was helpful with Tim coming here that he really looked at the broader financial sector and he looked at some vulnerabilities and he spoke publicly about some and he really encouraged us to have interdisciplinary efforts to understand those vulnerabilities.
Okay.
Yep.
Go ahead. Thank you.
I can give you a little bit of a background and take it where you want to go on the primary dealer credit facility and how that came about and how the monitoring unit came up. But as you know, on the weekend that Bear Stearns was acquired by JPMorgan Chase, at least the deal was struck to acquire them, that weekend, we established the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the primary dealer credit facility under 13(3) authority, which is, as you well know, not something we use and exercise in the normal course. And that was to provide some potential stability, some backstop funding for the remaining investment banks, given their dependence on wholesale funding and given the potential adverse reaction to the Bear Stearns episode. Immediately after that, it was decided that we needed to have a presence at those remaining independent investment banks primarily to make sure we had did a couple of things. First of all, remember, as PDCF, we're potentially a creditor, a lender to these firms. So we had to be in a position, if we ever needed to make a credit judgment and to know a couple of things, probably a few things. One, when would they come to us? We want some advance notice of that. We don't want to be totally surprised. We'd like to know the potential size of the borrowing. We'd like to know the rationale for the borrowing. And we'd like to understand, as best we could, and as quickly as possible, the overall financial condition of those firms. So, again, we're starting from ground zero, had no previous relationship with those firms. So acting very much as a creditor coming in. The second objective was to make sure that the creation of the PDCF didn't reduce the incentives for those broker-dealers to continue to build and actually accelerate the building of or strengthening of their liquidity position and their overall financial position. Kind of, you guys well know the moral hazard that we created potentially with the PDCF, so this unit was part of the stick to make sure they didn't become fat and happy with, the PDCF that was behind them. So we continued and we had a series of interactions with the firms to make sure that we're always pushing them to raise and build liquidity. To staff that unit, as Bill said, it was had a reporting line outside of bank supervision, but we drew heavily on bank supervision resources. We had two people And those were examiner types on site at each of the four remaining investment banks. We also had another probably seven or eight folks who were off-site but provided analytical support for that unit, and they were drawn from different areas of the bank in keeping with the multidisciplinary focus. So they were drawn from research, they were drawn from markets, they were drawn from legal. And basically, within 2 weeks, we had that structure set up. I remember working over Easter weekend that year to make sure we could outline the program. We staffed it up probably within the first 2 weeks of April, and we landed on site, you know, even before we were fully staffed. So that was in a broad outline, you know, the unit and what its intent was. Again, focused very much as a first instance on liquidity, understand the liquidity position, understand the funding model, very different from commercial banks. Clearly the implicit and explicit assumption of the broker dealers was that basically you needed to have this liquidity pool to be able to handle any unsecured borrowings that matured, let's say, up to a year. But the assumption was that the secured funding, the repo, that would always pretty much roll. Maybe have some higher haircuts, but that was, you know, that was the assumption. Bass Stearns proved that wrong. So we had to develop a framework from scratch for analyzing liquidity, and again, as I said, kind of push them to increase their liquidity.
And obviously having a dialogue with the SEC.
Absolutely, yeah. And it was, again, to Bill's point, very clear that the SEC was and the primary supervisor. They would remain the primary supervisor. So up front, the approach was to make sure we coordinated with them and certainly made sure that they knew they would continue to be the primary supervisor.
Periodic reports prepared on, I guess, then the five investment banks that you had two people in on site and 7 to 8 people in the office providing support for.
So we had the examiners on site producing pretty much daily reports on their funding. Remember, again, as I said, one of the issues or the points we wanted to make sure if ever the bank, one of the four banks, should come to us in a real way, you need to have a baseline, right? You know, if they come to us and say, we need X billion, you know, why is that? So you have to understand their funding. So very high frequency, almost real-time monitoring their funding positions.
Did they produce the daily reports since the beginning of the program or just when they got in trouble?
No, since pretty much the beginning of the program, once we got the protocol established, I would say in April sometime, started giving, you know, feeding back to the analytical unit, here's the daily information about the liquidity pool, the composition, et cetera, et cetera. So that was started early on. I lost my train.
Daily liquidity report.
Yeah,
in case
and we exactly. And we also produced a series of, again, developing a framework for analyzing liquidity, so-called liquidity scenario analysis stress tests. And we use that as a mechanism, as I said, to kind of come up with a framework. And a key element of those analyses were that the firms and we were assuming that this was before any PDCF access. So let us understand the funding position. Before they had to come to the PDCF, we had a couple of internal iterations about how we would do that. Then we went back to the firms, called them in, and said, listen, we'd like you to do this for us. We had the SEC right next to us. Said, we'd like you to go out and conduct a scenario analysis. We're going to give you the broad parameters, broad assumptions, and run this scenario. Come back to us. We're not going to be so fine-grained as to tell you all the assumptions, but we know when you come back to us, we're going to compare and contrast some of the assumptions you made about what amount of secured funding runs, and then we'll kind of normalize that, and we'll come up with kind of a first indication of where we think you need to make improvements, if at all, in terms of building liquidity. Again, the idea was to continue to push them, incent them, induce them to build liquidity to the point where they could continue to function in a period of what we call a sustained market disruption. The markets were still jittery then, after Bass Stearns. The idea wasn't to get them to a point where they could withstand Armageddon, i.e. a full run of loss of confidence. There's no amount of liquidity playing that can do that. So it was to make them more resilient and prevent them from getting too comfortable knowing that the PDCF was there behind them.
So the daily liquidity reports include who the counterparties are?
Didn't have a name by name, but we would get indications of if a certain counterparty the conversation with the bank treasuries was leaving or considering not rolling, so we'd get anecdotal information on that. It wasn't a full-scale A to Z listing, but we certainly wanted to know if there were significant counterparties that were going to exit the relationship or not roll their funding.
And the stress tests, I take it, the types of shocks, I take were both firm-specific and overall economy. And what happens if you take a one or two notch ratings downgrade? What happens if you report a loss as opposed to this?
Right.
What happens if interest rates change? What happens?
Right.
You know, those kind of
normal things,
right?
It was pretty much in the current environment, but there's some more idiosyncratic stress on the firm. Again, that's the full point of if everyone says, you know, not going to deal with them, but so we assumed haircuts and got to the point where, again, iterating with the firms and across the firms, we got to the point of which the haircut be on, let's say, a U.S. Treasury versus a investor-grade corporate bond versus a CDO. Unsecured funding, pretty much that all goes. That was the old assumptions that pretty much stuck. What would happen to rating downgrade in terms of additional collateral that you'd be required to post for your derivative contracts? How would people react to you in terms of maybe slowing payments on derivative contracts? You'd pay out, but they would maybe stagger. What type of potential novation or buybacks would you have to engage in to maintain confidence in your paper? So we worked through and got assumptions around all of those through various iterations, and that was kind of the model we used to develop our stress analyses and whether the liquidity pool was appropriately sized to cover those outflows under stress.
Mm-hmm. And then with these reports, did you guys also have a good feel on what the amount and composition of the liquidity pools were?
Sure. The liquidity pool concept was not new. That was kind of an existing concept. And the four broker-dealers or investment banks all disclosed those regularly. We had certainly got daily reporting on the liquidity pool. We got information on the holdings in the liquidity pool. We did not conduct an examination to verify the holdings in the liquidity pool. Actually, the SEC had done work on that. I'm not sure how frequently, but we knew that there was a relatively recent exam that they had done at the end of 07, early 08.
What about valuations of the stuff in the liquidity pool?
We did not have the amount of examiners on site, and we didn't have the supervisory mandate to go in and do the kind of work we do at a bank we had jurisdiction over. So we're not doing valuations. We're not testing their valuation process. I think the question is one that would have been something that we would have been forced to confront if we had stayed on site and this program had stayed and continued, let's say, a year, 6 months down the road. At some point, people would have asked, well, what's the next step? Once we got a handle on liquidity, where do you go from there? So as it worked out, we never got to the point where we were kind of digging down deeper in terms of valuation. So obviously, a number of the firms, and even chief amongst them, had huge real estate exposure. We did not have our two examiners go in and try to attempt to value that exposure, or even make an assessment of their internal valuation practices. The SEC would have had that under their authority and responsibility.
Would the SEC share that information with you guys?
There were two exams that we were quite very interested in. One was the examination of the liquidity pools, as I mentioned. The other was we had an understanding, I believe, that they had done some work on analyzing commercial real estate portfolios. We were not able to obtain any report on that. It's unclear, and I still don't know to this day whether it was just not concluded. So therefore, it was not in a form that was ready to be shared with us, but we did not receive results of that examination.
Okay. What about in terms of the liquidity pools, other than valuation, the issue of whether or not the assets listed in there were really available? I mean, one of the things you see in the Valukas report on Lehman are these comfort deposits and other things. Any work by you guys or the SEC, if you know, to determine, is the liquidity pool really there?
Yeah. Well, clearly, as Lehman came under stress in the latter part of the summer, we were, through our monitoring, identifying the fact that some of their clearing banks, their major clearing banks, had required additional collateral to cover intraday exposures, in some cases overnight exposure. So, again, that's one of that's something we kind of factored into our analysis, so we're certainly aware of that. When a firm is not under duress, it's not an issue per se. But we did pick it up when certain counterparties started to tighten up and demand more collateral from Lehman. So it's certainly something we were sensitive to.
Okay. So maybe sort of cut to the chase and hit the crux of at least what I'm really interested in, especially since given the timing we have here. And that is I don't know, probably both of you guys or all three of you folks. Mm-hmm. But we see, you know, the Lehman weekend come, and ultimately Lehman files bankruptcy, right, and does not receive exceptional government assistance. Mm-hmm. And 10 days, whatever it is, 14 days later, at least the vote is made by the FDIC at 6:30 in the morning on September 29th to invoke the systemic risk exception and approve Citi's assisted bid. And we certainly haven't seen all the documents, but as I said in the opening, the analysis seems to be very similar, if not exact, and that is, what's the counterparty implications of these firms going down, and then what's the more broader implications on the industry in general and the economy in general. So maybe you guys can sort of help us understand how the decisions were reached and why different decisions were reached for those two institutions.
I think the fundamental basic answer is there was an ability under the FDIC Act to invoke systemic risk and provide some assistance to facilitate that deal. That authority did not exist for a non-bank institution until about 2 weeks ago, I think. So it's not a question of we had the ability to do something for Lehman and we elected not to. We did not have the ability, full stop.
Okay, so let me ask about that a little.
Sure.
I'm sure you guys have been asked about this a ton. And that is, of course, 13.3,
right.
Was the authority that was used for PDCF, was the
yep.
authority that was used
right.
for the Baird deal, and I think was the authority that was used for AIG
right.
and a bunch of other stuff.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen, you know, both public and private documents, you know, indicating, and I guess the public documents and in the Veloukis report is, look, there wasn't sufficient collateral to do a 13.3 loan to Lehman. But in all the documents that we've seen, certainly not all the documents because there's too many of them, leading up to September 15th, mm-hmm. I don't see, you know, mm-hmm. any documents that say we can't do a 13.3 deal with Lehman because of a lack of collateral. In fact, the documents indicate, you know, another main lane type transaction is one of the alternatives being looked at. So help me understand why there was an authority when, and maybe it's because I just haven't seen the documents that
right.
exist that say this, or maybe there's some other reason. So help us understand that.
Yeah, I think we demonstrated a lot of creativity throughout the crisis in terms of all these facilities we introduced, but in terms of the Lehman, I don't, you know, the model was to go back to something that we had done, Bear Stearns, mm-hmm. right? So in the idea there in Bear Stearns, or what happened with Bear Stearns, there was an acquisition partner, an acquirer, JPMorgan Chase, and 13.3 was used to facilitate that acquisition. With respect to Lehman, the plan was, not surprisingly, to find an acquirer. And secondarily, to have a variant of what we did in 13.3, rather than the Fed finance the assets that really no one wanted, or in that case, J.P. Morgan didn't want. The idea was to get a consortium of their peers to finance that. So I think, as you well know, there was work going on in that stream over the weekend, and I was not directly involved in that, from what I understand. Those consortium of banks had reached an agreement on valuing the portfolio and providing that facility to take that out. On the acquirer front, as you well know, there were two potential acquirers, Bank of America and Barclays. Bank of America, as our general counsel is fond of saying, ran away with a different bride, Merrill Lynch. So Barclays was the partner at the kind of near the end of that weekend. Barclays was not able to consummate the deal. So, you know, we didn't have what I would call, as a commercial lender, a takeout. So why would we lend to Lehman Brothers when we didn't know how we were going to get paid back, to use a technical term, how it would be secured to our satisfaction? The entire the financial system is running from Lehman. We had just convened 10 or a dozen of their peers to say, listen, this is the weekend where, you know, either Lehman's going down or you guys are going to have to be part of the solution. So when that deal doesn't go down, they all know Lehman's, you know, in distress, and it was evident in the days before that. So we're going to step in and lend ultimately, was ultimately taxpayer money, to a firm where we don't know how we're going to get paid back. So, you know, the issue is we're not going to lend into a run without any way of getting paid back. What happened the next day was we went PDCF to the broker dealer because in terms of that that entity, we were taking, I was still taking a risk of winding that down in an orderly fashion. There is a resolution process for a broker dealer. It involves the SEC and SIPC. And we were going to facilitate that wind down. I think it was Monday or Tuesday. I think it was Tuesday. Then Barclays stepped up and said, you know what? We'll take the U.S. broker-dealer. We'll buy that. So we continue to lend throughout the week to fund the broker-dealer until that deal can be consummated on the Friday. So we had a takeout. We had Barclays behind us. And actually, we had, I think, Sherry, if I'm wrong, a guarantee from Barclays.
We had an agreement with Barclays whereby they were going to take us out.
Right.
They were
going
to assume our position once it was no longer a wind down and Barclays was stepping
right.
in.
Right.
Okay. So I may have just, in fact, I know I missed it because I have a squiggly here in the margin saying I didn't get that. You had the Barclays takeout after you made the $60 billion PDCF loan, right? But you mentioned something before that on why you were able to make it, why it was a different situation. Can you just say that again since I missed it?
So we're going to pull out all the stops and lend full-blown as much as we could to Lehman to, quote-unquote, save them. We're going to lend in a controlled fashion through the PDCF in terms of collateral that we had taken haircuts on to enable the U.S. broker-dealer to be wound down in an orderly fashion. So, I mean, there, you know, certainly I think you're aware that we took actions on that Sunday night, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York did, with of course, concurrence of the Board of Governors, to expand the PDCF. But again, and that was meant for the other broker-dealers, and much the same way that we created the PDCF after Bear Stearns had its demise, we were concerned about knock-on effects, run-on effects, so we expanded that access to the PDCF, but it was no way, you know, meant to, it was not going to be used for Lehman since Lehman was in the midst of a full-scale run. So we went in a controlled fashion around the U.S. broker-dealer assets, but we weren't going to go beyond that. I think we'll stop there.
And the distinction being that you expand the PDCF Sunday night and agree to lend to the broker dealer,
yes.
Not the consolidated entity.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was a board meeting? The Federal Reserve Board got together and said we're going to expand the PDCF? That was a 5-7 vote.
I wasn't at the Federal Reserve Board at the time, but 13-3, PDCF 13-3 sort of alters terms that had to be approved by the Board of Governors.
You can confirm that clearly with the board staff.
So was there talk at the time, and you have to live with me being thick and help me understand. I mean, I hear what you're saying. We don't want to lend into a run to the consolidated entity, but with the broker-dealer, it's safer.
Facilitate the wind down.
Right. But when you lend that 60, let me back up, when you lend that 60 bill, at that time, you don't have the Barclays takeout, right? You get that a day or two down the road.
Correct.
Right? Okay. So was there discussion or thought about, well, why don't we just lend the $60 billion to the consolidated entity? To buy time, basically, and to prevent this bankruptcy and to hopefully avoid the, who knows, systemic implications that may occur.
Lending to buy time is not a good strategy for getting paid back, and I think the lawyers can correct me if I'm wrong, but there would have been an authority question, right? We had 13-3 authority to lend to the broker-dealer. Do we have authority to lend to the consolidated holding company?
You can lend to anybody.
Well, we could have had a 13-3 decision.
Right, but under the PDCF, right,
yeah.
We could have done a separate 13-3 to lend to
any IPC. Lending under the PDCF was collateralized.
Sure.
I mean, it wasn't an unlimited guarantee of all of the obligations of Lehman Brothers, which is what the difference is. And Art, if you could, can you just explain a little bit the difference between why having Chase in the Bear Stearns scenario made a big difference versus not having anybody in the Lehman scenario?
Sure. One of the issues with having, you know, an acquirer at the ready was that would provide comforts to the firms, in this case, and that, well, in that case, Bear's counterparties, that someone would be able to pay them back. And actually, J.P. Morgan Chase offered a guarantee. They had to offer a guarantee. They came to the point where it was required for them to offer the guarantee to prevent the continued erosion of counterparties away from Bear Stearns. So the same thing would have been necessary in either the Bank of America or the Barclays case, because an acquisition would be consummated, you know, on the spot. So between the time when a deal was agreed to consummate an acquisition and the actual consummation, there would need to be a guarantee provided by a strong counterparty. In this case, that would have been within Barclays. Otherwise, why would the counterparties take a chance of hanging around with the deal doesn't go through?
Right. So, and on, of course, we've read in press and other places, you know, the whole Barclays guarantee issue has apparently contributed, at least, to that deal not going down that Sunday night. But was there discussion about how much time it was going to take for Barclays to do the shareholder vote and see whether or not they would do the guarantee? And again, maybe buying time isn't the right phrase to use, but if that shareholder vote was going to occur, you know, within the week, you know, was there discussion about we can make a loan and at least bridge the gap to the shareholder vote, and then if it doesn't work, go the route that you guys went?
Just as from a legal perspective, just to be clear, a loan is one thing, a collateralized lending under 13.3, in a secure to our satisfaction. We did not, at that point in time, have the legal authority to make a guarantee. We did not make a guarantee of limits, obligations. We didn't have the legal authority to do it.
Okay.
So, go ahead.
My recollection is fuzzy on the time would have been required to take the shareholder vote, but if I recall correctly, because the shareholder vote would have taken weeks or a month, they would have had to send out the proxy, whatever their equivalent of proxy material is, and had to have convened and had the vote. You had to have the guarantee between that time and the shareholder vote. And then I think that ended up being, well, you need, then we were told, again, not UK counsel, that you also need a shareholder and a vote. You need a shareholder vote to actually do the guarantee. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, again, I wasn't directly involved in those conversations with the UK FSA or the UK Treasury, but my understanding is it was pretty clear that there was no possibility of that coming through with any kind of clarity in the near term. So.
Okay. So I know you guys didn't work on AIG, and maybe sure you can address this, or maybe you guys can generally, but the next day, an $85 billion loan is made to AIG, and there's nobody acquiring AIG. Mm-hmm. If you can, I mean, I know you guys aren't the AIG guys, help me understand why we can't make a loan to Lehman on Sunday the 15th mm-hmm. or Monday the 15th, but we can make an $85 billion loan to AIG the next day.
Can I try to handle that, since I'm not the AIG person, but I can give it a crack
if my attorney's let me.
The disclaimer's on the tape.
Sure,
all,
thanks
all
very
good.
Much. Bill's one of my personal lawyers. I personally account sometimes. We joke around. I think the simple answer is, again, from my understanding of AIG, there's a case where you had a relatively contained and relative to the size of the organization, small, I guess, in quotes, because we're talking big numbers here, AIGFP, which was the cancer, and he had all these operating insurance subsidiaries that were not affected by, I guess, the cancer. And the assessment was, again, I was not part of this, that, you know, we could be secured to our satisfaction by taking the shares in the operating insurance companies as collateral. With Lehman, we cannot get secured to our satisfaction because it was much more the whole firm. And, you know, you didn't have these other assets that were clean, separable, distinct part of the company you can get comfortable with. So it's a different organization in terms of, and a different, I guess, for lack of a better word, source of the problem. It was more contained than my understanding in AIG.
Okay. So is it accurate then, since you had this monitoring start back in March mm-hmm. of 2008, and we're getting these daily reports and other reports, whether from your folks or from the SEC, that you guys knew from March through September 15 that Lehman didn't have sufficient collateral during that whole, I mean, I know things change over time, but did you realize, you know, throughout that time period that, look, we know if there's not an acquirer here, we're not going to be able to do an AIG kind of $85 billion loan, because from monitoring the liquidity and monitoring the liquidity pool and looking at the institution on a consolidated basis, it's just not there.
Well, we didn't know about AIG.
Oh, I understand. Right, right.
April, so. I think, may I answer this way? I think the fundamental issue is that, you know, in Lehman's last days, there was complete loss of confidence in the firm. And when you're dealing with that kind of issue, and, you know, financial institutions, it's you're dealing in confidence, there's no amount of liquidity that's going to be able to save them. So what we're doing in the PDCF, again, as I said, we're trying to push the banks to build liquidity, to continue to operate in a period of sustained stress, continue to understand what their baseline funding needs are and be able to ascertain any variations in that. But it was not to get them to the point where they could withstand a full, you know, run on the bank. Mm-hmm. That was just not the intent. So that assessment wouldn't have held for Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch. You know, people whose total confidence in their run, there's no amount of liquidity you're going to have to lend against.
I would also say that throughout the spring and summer, Lehman was exploring options to deal with its fundamental issues, whether it was selling pieces of the organization that it tried hard to do, or getting investments in the organization, or spinning off some of the commercial real estate, or exploring with us and the FDIC the prospect of moving some of the assets into that ILC I mentioned up front, and having the capacity of the ILC's funding to support assets so transferred. There were a bunch of different alternatives that Lehman was exploring to deal with the vulnerabilities that they recognized that they had, and we recognized that they had, but those vulnerabilities increased in intensity, as you know, as we moved into the fall, with the GSEs probably the first key piece, and then a series of other major firms getting in trouble as the market singled them out as being particularly vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And Lehman was singled out as being particularly vulnerable.
You know, one of the alternatives you mentioned there in terms of Lehman trying to right the ship, for lack of a better term, was becoming a bank holding company, which, of course, we know after the fact Goldman and Morgan Stanley did. They didn't. And I believe I even saw a reference, at least in the Veloukis report, that Mr. Geithner said he viewed that as sort of a gimmicky approach by Lehman, which for me was curious because Goldman and Morgan Stanley did do it. But can you comment on that alternative and what the thinking was within the New York Fed on Lehman becoming a bank holding company and trying to get access to funding that way?
Whoever. Because I was involved in some of the broad discussions on becoming a bank holding company, where we explained to Lehman some of the elements of supervisory approach that would apply to bank holding companies, and explained some of the activity limits, etc. And Tim and the CEO, Dick Fold, did talk about the market reaction to setting up a bank holding company that didn't have any other purpose other than putting a holding company on top of the investment bank, and what the market reaction would likely be. And I would say that both Tim and Dick had similar reactions, that if that's what we'd end up being able to do, just doing that one structural change, the market would likely say, well, that doesn't fundamentally change things for the organization. And the fact that they feel they need to do that could be viewed negatively by the marketplace as a reach to seem to fall within the Fed's umbrella. I do think the dynamics of the situation did change in the course of the fall, and things became more intense. And when that option was thought of by Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, it was one that we and ultimately the Board of Governors approved the applications for them to become bank holding companies. And I don't think there was a negative market reaction. There may have been some positive market reaction at that stage.
Yeah, I mean, the context was totally, even though it was only a few months apart, totally different.
Right? It was the summer when...
So was there a specific debate at some point? They were on the eve of filing for VHC status and decided not to, or they were specifically rejected? Was there a moment of decision on either side in terms of the views?
I remember most strongly conference calls one weekend where we were exploring orally what would be involved in holding company formation, its implications, market reactions. I don't know that there was a great deal of paper filed with us. I'm confident there was no application filed. It was more of a going through conceptually the various elements in part of Lehman's overall strategic planning process that included, as I just ticked off, these three or four other kinds of alternatives that they had in play to try to deal with their fundamental issues.
Was there, in those conversations, was there anything like, if we filed, what would you do kind of question, and then if so, what was the reaction from them to it fit?
What would we do?
Right. If they filed, did they inquire or get the impression from the bank, from the Federal Reserve, in terms of what the reaction might be if they...
You mean whether it would be positively reacted to or not? I don't think it got quite that precise. I don't think the question was teed up with Tim or me in the way you quite described it. It was more what's involved in holding company formation and what would be the value of trying to do that and what would you really gain in terms of access that you wouldn't already have.
In that regard, a big issue seemed to be the 23A issue. You know, could they downstream a lot of the commercial, I think mainly a lot of the commercial real estate, maybe some of the CDO assets, from the holding company into the bank? I mean, and I think there seemed to be going back and forth between a 23A with the ILC or whether the 23A would be more palatable if you created a formal bank holding company, which would obviously give the Fed more control over any downstreaming. Do you remember that being part of the discussion in July?
It was less linked than the way you're describing it. The 23A discussion was a major discussion that went on with the Fed during a good hunk of July and with the FDIC during a good hunk of August. The holding company formation by itself doesn't fundamentally change the decision criteria on the appropriateness of moving assets from a parent, whether you call it a holding company or just a parent, or a non-bank affiliate, ultimately into a bank. The Federal Reserve has jurisdiction under Section 23A of the Federal Reserve Act to make judgments on whether to grant waivers from the general prohibition on the moving of assets in that way. And through extensive exploration with me and with senior people from board staff, particularly Mark Vanderweide, who was then in the legal division, we went through all the various protections that we thought would need to be in place before we could even consider a favorable action on a 23A waiver request. And there were a bunch of considerations in terms of the capital of the bank, and the ILC, while it's not a bank holding company, right. Act bank, is an insured depository institution. So we wanted to make sure it was protected. So we wanted the capital of the ILC to be strong. We wanted the nature of the assets going over not to include low-quality assets, which it really can't under the way the 23A waiver process is structured. And we didn't want assets that were on the cusp of being low-quality. We wanted strong parental guarantees, and we wanted a mechanism to ensure that the parent would honor those guarantees. So it was a very involved process from both the supervisory and legal perspective. That process ended with the Fed, and I basically advised Lehman, I think it was in early August, that we wouldn't be asking more questions of them. We would really look to them to have a dialogue with the FDIC as the supervisor of the ILC to make a judgment as to what whether they were open to it, whether they wanted further protections, and that after that discussion finalized, then we would really bring the decision to the board for an ultimate judgment for the 23A waiver. And that's not fundamentally different, whether we're talking about moving the assets into something that has a broader commercial bank charter, or whether we're talking about moving the assets into something that has the specialized ILC charter in Utah, I guess.
And my question was whether you think they thought that perhaps if we do the bank holding company route, we can accomplish more of what we want under 23A, and that they, in a sense, lost some interest in the bank holding company route when they realized it's not going to help us any. I mean, did you have any sort of sense that that was part of their thinking?
I don't recall that explicit linkage, but if they had asked me, I would have given the same answer I gave you. Right. With what would be involved with a 23A waiver, regardless of whether it was part of a literal bank holding company or movement into a ILC owned by a parent.
Some documents we've seen indicate that there was a real that these conversations in July were occurring against a real background of stress, that some of their counterparties were pulling out sometime around the 11th of July. I think Federated and Dreyfus were pulling out or reducing their positions, and these conversations were, you know, if not as bad as September, were right. Certainly in a very stressed situation. And I think one document that we've seen indicated that Bill Dudley at that point, you know, went through sort of a bear type scenario, a 13-3 type scenario. And at that point, at least in the notes I've seen of Mr. Dudley, he wasn't saying that we would only do this, you know, with a takeout. In other words, that it was sort of, can we think about doing a bear 13-3 or not? Do you recall the discussions being held at that time about, okay, Lehman may go right now? And if so, are we prepared to you know, do a liquidity type support to prevent that from happening?
I think certainly the pressure was building incrementally on Lehman over the course of the late spring, early summer. They announced their second quarter loss, that they were still on the May fiscal cycle,
yeah.
Or the November, so it would have been
June,
May,
right.
So it would have been early mid-June.
Yeah.
And you're right, it certainly wasn't at the level where it was in, I would say, late August, when clearly saw more than, and even right before then, like I said, the last week or so of August, it really started to become apparent and to build. So it was kind of more the, you know, everyone kind of had a sense that they were the next one on the list, if, you know, there was a list of firms to go, and the question is whether they're going to be able to pull out the stops and do something to reinforce, or not reinforce, but to build confidence in them, and with their earnings, you know, coming at, and what's going to be like, you know, again, July is two-thirds of the way through the quarter, kind of indications that it's not going to be a turnaround that way.
Right.
So it's building incrementally, and the clock's ticking, but the sense of imminent demise. I remember seeing that, and the way I took that, it was more of a broad kind of, okay, again, we're creative, but we kind of go back to things that sometimes have worked. So it's, I think it was very much focused on how to get the bad assets, the perceived bad assets, you know, out. And that's one type of solution, but it never, and as far as I can tell, got to the point where, okay, we need to do this, we should go ahead and do this, was more of a conceptual,
right.
Create an SPV,
I sort of read it
get it out.
If suddenly the crisis comes right now. But, I mean, what's interesting is in that analysis, you don't see him saying, we would only do this with a takeout. I mean, that I think we couldn't even consider doing it without a takeout. And there's one other factor I wondered whether it was important to you, that in July, you have not only Lehman but Merrill. And
mm-hmm.
Merrill, from the monitoring reports I've seen, was in as bad shape as Lehman. Maybe some people thought even worse.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have been affected by the fact, you know, if we don't solve Lehman, then Merrill goes? Obviously, when you get to the weekend, in a sense, in the middle of the weekend, you've solved Merrill. Merrill's not on the table anymore. I mean, could that have affected your decision-making that, you know, if Lehman gets to a crisis and we let Lehman go, Merrill's right here, and we have no solution for Merrill? Do you think that affected the Fed's thinking in July as to what they were facing, if suddenly, everybody pulled on Lehman?
I don't believe so. I don't think we're looking at it that way. And we knew both firms were vulnerable, and we're doing all we could to kind of push them to improve their position. There was also, I guess, work going on looking at the tri-party repo mechanism, and we know that was a source of vulnerability from Bear. So a lot of thinking going on about, you know, what can we do to improve the resilience of the market. And, you know, a lot of blue sky going on, but, you know, I wouldn't want to have you take Bill's email out of context. It was kind of a structural thing that we could do, but it wasn't like, okay, let's do this right now.
I mean, I think Kaitner was very big on us doing brainstorming and thinking about possible solutions and ways to spread foam on the runway. It was one of his favorite expressions in the event that we did solution A versus solution B. Mm. So you'll see stuff in the record where various people wrote up thoughts that were kicked around that for a variety of reasons did not translate into ultimate actions. I mean, clearly during that weekend we had the principals heavily engaged, and between Hank Paulson and Chris Cox and Bernanke,
right.
And the principals were heavily engaged and were making judgments on which of the options really could pass muster.
One per se on AI.
Was it the case there was a point of decision, and was that point of decision over the Lehman weekend to reject a maiden lane type approach to safety?
Well, again, as Hart was describing, we didn't have the elements of a maiden lane approach that were there. We didn't have a JPMC prepared to step in and do the various key parts of the acquisition.
Oh, so even though the email that we've been talking about doesn't reference the existence of a purchaser, that would be, we should presume that's part of the background of your thinking. And
it certainly was, as I obviously can't speak for Bill, but yeah. But as we ran into that weekend, it was very much in our mind that we were looking for a private sector solution, and we were looking for Barclays or B of A as far and away the most likely elements of the solution package. As we were doing brainstorming over the preceding several months, not all those elements would have been ticked off in anyone's description of a possible way forward.
One question I have is there's a planning memo of September 10th, and there's a part here, part four, where there's discussion about liquidity support, and it looks as if it's very much focused on a consortium, the consortium approach. And I wondered whether you know whether during these discussions on the weekend, where maybe it became clear, perhaps, that there wasn't going to be a single takeout acquisition partner, that did the Fed or the decision makers ever say, well, look, you know, we don't have an acquisition takeout, but you know, we would provide liquidity backup for a consortium of people, maybe to take everything, you know, outside the broker-dealer, essentially, because you're prepared to support the broker-dealer. And that would indicate that there was at least some thinking that we should have a liquidity number in mind that we would put on the table to work with the consortium. And do you know whether that kind of offer was ever made to the group, sort of saying, we don't want to leave here with a bankruptcy, and so if you can take everything but the broker-dealer, you know, we're prepared to put, you know, X billion of PDCF behind the consortium. Do you know that discussion ever, you know, took place or was considered? Because the consortium idea just seems to not go anywhere. It just seems to die.
My understanding is the consortium worked in terms of financing the equivalent of the bad Bear assets, the quote-unquote bad Lehman assets. Again, I wasn't involved in those discussions. They took place in this building, a different floor, but my understanding is that they reached consensus with the consortium to take out these, was it $25, $40 billion, whatever the number was, of real estate assets. So everything I understand, that was solved.
I mean, Tom Baxter.
And then that would clear the way for Barclays to pick up the remainder. So that piece sort of was.
If you hold the broker-dealer over here and you have the $25 to $40 billion of real estate assets over here, then what's left in the middle? In other words, that's sort of the question, which, you know, which in a sense, wasn't being picked up by
Barclays. Well, it's not just the broker-dealer, right? Because, I mean, the broker-dealer is a major piece.
No, that's
right?
About half, I understand it. About half of Lehman was the broker-dealer.
Yeah, but Barclays didn't take the whole broker-dealer, just to be clear. They cherry-picked assets. They took some and
but
some assets.
In other words, as you're talking through this weekend, in other words, it sounds like you had a potential deal for this basket of assets.
Right.
You had at least, I suspect, a potential deal for most of the broker-dealer. You know, what was left in between, and what would it have taken to support, you know, some, you know, acquisition of that?
Again, my understanding is that Barclays would have taken everything but the commercial real estate and residential real estate assets that the consortium was going to take.
Right.
That was that was the plan. And then when that fell through, they came back on Tuesday and said, we'll just pick up these pieces of the U.S. broker-dealer.
The documents indicate that you were in discussion with the SEC that there was a pretty firm decision that you weren't going to let the broker-dealer fail, that a disorderly failure, the broker-dealer just was considered not at all, you know, feasible or possible. So I guess what I'm trying to explore is once Barclays walks, and obviously Bank of America's taken Merrill, you're sort of left with a scenario where you're going to do whatever it takes to keep the broker-dealer going until something happens to the broker-dealer, an orderly wind down.
We're going to ship it to wind the broker-dealer down.
Right.
It may take a few days up to,
right. You have a consortium and I frankly couldn't see this in the documents. You have a consortium that had agreed to take, you know, this basket of assets.
Right.
So what's left in the middle, and was there thought given to, well, can we close the gap between the broker-dealer over here and the basket over here, as opposed to, you know, letting everything with the broker-dealer fail, essentially?
I'm not sure Art's the right person to answer these. I think if you want those answers, Tom Bass would be the person. I also, again, urge you, I think the Lehman Examiner report, and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it goes into this in pretty great detail.
I think that's right, and I'm just not sure conceptually if it's right that there's broker-dealer over here, commercial real estate over here, and something in the middle. I mean, I think Lehman's balance sheet was like $700 billion, so I think there's potentially a lot of other stuff out there, and just we're not confusing concepts. The consortium was not a potential acquirer. The consortium was just going to finance this pool of that assets.
Right, I understand.
To facilitate. And
my other question about AIG is
that they were going to essentially play the role that the Fed played in the Bear Act.
That 2 weeks after the original basket, you pump in $40 billion more. Was that because the AIG problem was not as contained as you thought, or?
Well, again, this we're not the right people to really probe the AIG.
Okay. Let me, as I'm looking at the clock on the phone and seeing time tick away, switch gears a little and ask you about some other areas that we're interested in. And that is, you had mentioned, you know, things were getting worse over time with Lehman, that the pressure was building incrementally. Do you recall or know what counter? We all know Reserve Primary Fund apparently thought Lehman was too big to fail because they stayed in. But were you seeing certain types of counterparties or certain particular counterparties that were pulling out before others and others that were staying in, and by doing so, perhaps impliedly thought that Lehman was too big to fail and that the government would not let them fail?
Didn't you know? You mentioned, I guess, a few minutes ago, the I think Federated or someone else.
Dreyfus.
That may have been the case. I don't recall specifically, but there wasn't, you know, from what I recall, a lot of or even significant counterparty erosion in the early part of the summer. Let's say, you know, July-ish. Maybe they're an isolated piece that we picked up on our monitoring, but it wasn't since that it's starting.
Right.
I think the first indications we have were more around probably late August, the 20th and after, when some of the clearing banks began to kind of demand additional collateral. And that's kind of where that was, kind of, I want to use the term loosely, the beginning of the end. But prior to that, didn't see a lot of counterparty erosion.
And, of course, seen in the Veloukis report, the stuff on Citi and J.P. Morgan, I mean, let me just demonstrate my ignorance. Were there other clearing banks that were demanding more collateral than those?
Yeah,
two?
I believe HSBC was. I believe Bank of America was. And there may have been others as well.
I should remember that from the Veloukis report. They went through those guys. thank you. And then, again, on the same subject, Wachovia. I mean, from folks we've talked to and from documents I've seen, it looks like there's really not a huge counterparty erosion, to use the same term, until the Friday after WAMU, and even then, not until after lunchtime for some reason. Was that your, whoever's the right
we
person?
We kind of shifted Diane.
So I'll just, so at that time, I, in the structure that Bill mentioned, it's important to note that he mentioned the LFIT, and under the LFIT, there is this risk secretariat risk specialty officer. So I was dual-hatted. I was the head of the credit risk department of examiners and experts here at the New York Fed and Bank Supervision, and I also held the credit risk specialty officer hat across the system. And our mandate prior to, but you know, was very helpful during the stressful period, was to come up with ways of looking at institutions that had similar portfolios, mortgage portfolios, similarly situated, or maybe the outside world would think them to be similarly situated. We needed more detail about what was the composition of those portfolios, how were they faring, what were loss potential, non-performings, charge-offs, etc. We were doing that through a variety of cutting it by business type or risk type across the set of institutions that fell within the LFIT portfolio. So in the context of Wachovia, we were monitoring, Wachovia would have been included in the large mortgage originator. We were monitoring on a consumer portfolio, then a commercial real estate portfolio as well. And then also we started to, we have had actually not leveraging off of or making sure we were in a consistent fashion thinking about the liquidity, doing something similar to what Art was doing on the IBs. Collecting more, you know, very frequent, high-frequency, daily information about their liquidity. Much of that was trying to get at, I think, the questions you asked, Art, about the IBs, the composition of the firm's liquidity funding profile, much different, much more textured to it relative to an IB, and, you know, what were the vulnerabilities to it. Part of that, we also then started collecting information on, we call it a counterparty, thinking about of the largest of the LFITs, who's exposed to whom, and most of that is driven by derivative activity, secured lending activity. Wachovia had a smaller proportion of that type of activity to the other LFITs relative to the big major dealers. So I would say that my recollection is through our compilation. Also, I should say that information we were gathering and disseminating to appropriate relevant members, the LFIT had representatives obviously from our Reserve Bank, board staff, the Reserve Banks in Richmond, San Francisco. So we were the hope to be the clearinghouse of trying to get comparable information and disseminate it as soon as we had it and processed it.
So obviously you were getting reports from the Richmond Fed.
Absolutely.
On a tremendously frequent basis.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it would be, I think we got updates, you know, intraday often, and then it was just a matter of, as Art was doing on the IBs, just for frame of reference, coming up with a sort of a consistent, systematic way of trying to put all the information so that when we looked across the firms, were we seeing differences or similarities. For Wachovia, I recall it being, you know, in terms of its not having as much trading activity or exposure, not getting a sense that counterparties were pulling away. I think it was more a, obviously, you know, there were signs, but it was more a question of, how are the losses in the, they are similar, they have a big consumer retail activity that was deteriorating. How are those losses feeding through the institution and thinking about its capitalization?
And I understand that, and the payment option arm book and all the provision for loan losses there. And, you know, in the reports we've, the liquidity reports you've seen, not the asset quality reports, you do see a like a $30 billion decline in deposits in the third quarter, and I don't have the granularity by month other than knowing I think like there was an $11 billion decline in July. But, you know, for an $800 billion institution, that wasn't that big a deal in terms of a run. And, you know, when we see maturity shortening and prices going up and the usual kind of stuff for just counterparties being a little more careful, perhaps, and reducing exposure. But I haven't seen or heard from anyone that there was really a run on the bank that led to the government needing to take a close look and ultimately invoking the systemic risk exception. Until that Friday, after WAMU failed. I mean, that seemed to be the precipitating event because uninsured creditors took hits in the WAMU failure. And I think a lot of people
said Wamu's got a lot of payment option arms, Kobe's got a lot of payment option arms, they're next. And I think Friday when Kobe even comes out and says, well, now we're for sale, or they even call perhaps, maybe not you guys, but the Richmond Fed or the OCC and say, we're in trouble when there's issues. I mean, so what I'm really trying to get your sense of, was there any kind of, you know, counterparty pullback on Wachovia before that Friday, at least to the level of, holy moly, we need to deal with this?
You know, the Richmond Fed would be best positioned for that texture. I mean, I could give you a sense of a newer firm because, again, it's this division of labor here. I would have been in the role of trying to get the higher level cross firm. Mm-hmm. Then that's used by each reserve bank for their institution-specific supervision. The Richmond Fed would have been better positioned.
Okay.
I recall, so it's a partnership with the Richmond Fed and all of us who are trying to process it cross-firm. They then would have been doing, if you will, the more detailed, on-the-ground, minute-by-minute conversation with the firm about the specifics. I just was not involved in those conversations in July.
Okay. And just to go back, one of the things you said, you're getting reports from the Richmond Fed as part of the LFIT program. Mm-hmm. Are you also getting information from the OCC?
Yes, we're talking with the OCC regularly. Oftentimes, it will depend upon Reserve Bank. Mm-hmm. But so we had set up, I'm going to talk in the period of around August to September, August to October.
Sure.
We had regular, so we are organizing ourselves within the Federal Reserve, and there's regular contact being made with each Reserve Bank and their representatives, their OCC representatives for a given institution. And then I recall there being conversations system-wide, Federal Reserve to DC office at the OCC, very regular intervals, to talk about, are we seeing similar things? Do we have a difference of opinion? Oftentimes, I recall, for example, a collection of liquidity data and counterparty data, OCC, you know, everybody agrees this is a good thing to do. Yes, I do recall very frequent conversation about both substance and what we needed to get and how to achieve the objective of more information, regular monitoring.
Okay. Wachovia apparently has an unassisted deal with Wells on Friday. Apparently that deal is still good on Saturday, and apparently that deal falls apart Sunday morning. Do you have any color on what happened there?
Not too much color. I mean, I remember very well coming into the office on Sunday morning thinking I was only going to be in for a few hours, and I ended up staying for 36 hours. So we obviously knew there was a lot of discussion going on between Wells and Wachovia, but then the course of the day on Sunday, there was the increasing sense that an unassisted deal wasn't going to come to fruition, so that the prospect of some kind of a bidding process involving Wells and Citi for Wachovia to get FDIC support was the increasing reality during the day on Sunday.
Was Citi looking at Wachovia before Sunday?
My recollection is there had been some discussion with them prior to the weekend. Certainly in the course of the weekend, there was periodic discussions as to the prospect of going for an assisted deal. I don't think I heard any prospect of an unassisted deal, certainly in that time frame.
Now, we know that on probably the end of your 36-hour day, at 6:30, right? But in that FDIC board meeting, they vote to approve the systemic risk exception and accept Citi's bid. We've seen, you know, the memos by the Richmond Fed and the FDIC and the transcript in the board minutes from that meeting. And there's an indicator in there that there are some conference calls amongst the big players before that actual board meeting, including, I think, you know, Chairman Baer and Mr. Geithner and, you know, the main players. Were you guys involved in those conference calls? And the reason I ask, put it in context, when you read the minutes of the approval, you know, Baer is sitting there saying that he doesn't know if it's the right decision. She's acquiescing. Of the five board members, you know, at least according to the transcript in the minutes, she's the one that's saying, look, the Fed and the Treasury and the OCC have weighed in on this, and they think we should do it. My staff is arguing we should do it. I don't really know, but I'm going to acquiesce. So it sort of implies that perhaps
she needed to be persuaded the previous day. So I'm wondering, and then we see the indications in the documents about conference calls before that actual meeting. So I just like to get additional color on that,
sure,
to the extent I can.
Sure. There were at least two conference calls early in the morning of, I guess it's Monday, September 29th. I'm not going to be precise on the time of the calls. One might have been 2-ish. One might have been 3:30-ish or whatever. There were...
Sorry?
A.M.
Yes, right.
A.M.
Board meeting was at 6:30 a.m., so you know that. Right?
And Tim Geithner was definitely part of the discussion process in those several calls, and I listened in to those two calls. There was extensive discussion about what Wells was prepared to offer slash look for, discussion of what Citi was prepared to offer slash look for. There was discussion more broadly about the appropriateness of an assisted deal. I would say the earlier call ended with Sheila asking, was saying that she's going to have her troops do some further review of the actual submissions or the scope of what the ask was. And then on the second call, there was, again, extensive discussion of how you look at two proposals that had slightly different elements. So the maximum protection was slightly different. The scaling of the protection was different. So the FDIC staff, between the two calls, had done an analysis of which one would be favored by the FDIC in terms of exposure to the fund. And at the end of the later call, advised that they would be supportive of Citi rather than over Wells.
But was there discussion or the need for persuasion in terms of accepting either deal, and as opposed to just, we're going to do a liquidation lease cost resolution and we're not going to invoke the systemic risk exception?
I would say, Chris, that there was extensive discussion of a series of related questions, including whether Treasury would provide some kind of support to the FDIC and how this would be costed, depending, and you understand that process better than I, but how it would be costed in terms of the FDIC's budget process. There was extensive discussion with all of the parties. I think John Dukin was party to those discussions as well. About that range of options, and coming out somewhat inconclusively after that first series of, well, the first conference call that I alluded to. And then the second conference call, there was less focus on whether we should do it and more focus on which of the two should we do.
Okay.
Was there serious consideration by any of the key decision makers on just saying, look, we just need to let Wachovia, go through the normal, non-systemic risk process? Or did they all agree that it was systemically important?
I would say that the majority of the people in the room clearly were pressing that there was really systemic implications, taking into account all of the lead-up, including WAMU and including everything we've been talking about with Lehman AIG, et cetera, that we, I think, collectively believed that there was a real systemic issue. I would say probably the FDIC asked more questions as to the array of issues and possibilities, since in the final analysis they were making the judgment. So I think very properly, Sheila, who did virtually all the talking from the FDIC's vantage point, was asking questions and exploring necessities and exploring who would be supporting whom if the decision were ultimately made to do an assisted deal.
Now, as I recall the statute, the Fed itself is required to take a two-thirds vote in favor of the systemic risk exception. So was there any dissent or concern among the board members of the Fed, as far as you know, about whether Wachovia should be done that way?
And you can certainly confirm that right. with the board and its staff. To my knowledge, no.
Right. Do you think it's fair to say that what happened after Lehman informed the Fed's views about what to do with Wachovia? In other words, that the response to Lehman turned out to be somewhat different, perhaps, than you thought it would be, coming out of that weekend in September?
I'd put it in slightly broader terms, that the overall market dynamics were different by that weekend, and it wasn't just the Lehman situation, it was the WaMu situation and
AIG,
right. So it was a buildup. But I also think, as Art alluded to, I think in response to one of Chris's questions early on, there was a tool available given that it was basically a bank situation rather than a non-bank situation that was not available in dealing with Lehman and AIG vis-a-vis dealing with Wachovia.
One question I have, going back to Lehman weekend just once again, is a lot of the documents leading up to that weekend on counterparty exposures and what you could call ripple effects are very much focused on the derivatives books and the repo books and interbank lending. There isn't much discussion of commercial paper issues. Do you know whether the commercial paper issue was thought much about before the final decision was made on Lehman?
Again, a lot of analysis trying to figure out, what the impacts are going to be. I don't think anyone was under the impression that, as I said before, that it will be fine. I think Tim uses the words that, we know it will be bad, and we don't know how bad it's going to be. But again, it wasn't a choice to say, well, it's not going to be so bad, so we'll let it go. Well, I won't plow that ground. In terms of commercial paper, my sense is we were looking at money market kind of exposure, but I don't know if we ever got to the level of saying this fund has X exposure to Lehman. I don't think we had the data available at that time to see that. So,
if one goes back, let's say to 1998, the commercial paper market right. sort of froze up, after the Russian default. Would that experience have led you to think, commercial paper is a possible choke point or trouble spot? If there's a default by a major player?
We knew the system as itself would be under a shock, so it's all the short-term investors, whether it's, it's money market funds that factors into commercial paper, repo financing, so I just don't think we had the granularity of data at our fingertips to know the exposures of...
Right. Where the choke point would come first, essentially.
Right. We didn't know it was on the reserve fund first. Okay.
Two quick questions. You mentioned earlier that after Bear failed, you put on-site examiners at the four remaining major mm-hmm. iBanks.
Yep.
Any other institutions that you didn't have direct responsibility over that you started looking at that point?
We put on-site...
There's AIG in play. Right. There's all sorts of...
A couple of things. We didn't... The PDSEP was available to all... any broker dealer. So a number of most of the broker dealers were affiliated with a bank holding company, so we had insights there. We had the four remaining independent investment banks. We put folks on site. We had a couple of, actually one outlier, Cantor Fitzgerald, which was not really major. It wasn't huge. And it wasn't associated with a bank or bank holding company. We did not put anyone on site, but they started to borrow from the PDCF. So we had our monitoring team work with our colleagues in the markets group to do more analysis around Cantor, and we eventually got to the point where we actually made a visit to Cantor, didn't have folks on site, but made a couple of visits, had conversation with them, and ultimately got to a point where we kind of gave them some pretty strong signals they ought to wind down their exposure to the PDCF. The other thing I would say more broadly, I think during that time, and particularly as we got into August, September-ish, I think people started to think more broadly about the system. So I think there were a couple of big insurance companies we started to, Beth started to look at.
Yeah, I think that was based on public information, trying to size.
But no one on site and no direct conversations. Other than that, I don't.
On site aside, did you, and you said you sort of broadly looked at, but did you have people dedicated to looking at any particular group?
Just to elaborate on Art's point, it's in the context of who
Kuzkovlik market share, just again trying to refresh our, you know, reconfirm our understanding of who are big players in certain areas. That would have been part of the mandate of the group that Bill mentioned early on, which is this sort of monitoring team that we had, which just thought about banks. You can't think about banks in isolation, but banks have certain activities that others conduct. Broadly, what does public information say? What might be a vulnerability?
Among the large insurers, was AIG in that group?
This was happening at the time of AIG, and again, thinking about more broadly, September.
This wasn't happening in the March-April time period.
No, from a legal perspective, the reason that we had the teams on site at the primary dealers was because of the PTCF, because of our role as a lender, and we were there with the consent of the firms. We don't have supervisory authority. We didn't have it over AIG. We still don't have it. We couldn't have gone into AIG and done the same thing in the same way that we were able to with PTCF from the primary dealer firms.
What we heard from the board down in Washington was the AIG was on the radar. Are there any other firms like that that sort of qualified as somebody you should have been looking at, that you started looking at?
Okay, I think as we got into September, and certainly in the aftermath of Fannie, Freddie, Lehman, and AIG, started to take a closer look at the GE Capitals, their funding position, right? They were certainly had a lot of commercial paper outstanding, so that started in September. And I believe our markets folks also, they had a conversation with a number of market participants. One of the participants, relatively large, who they had a conversation with, and they brought several into a Citadel as well. They weren't fresh at the time.
It was a focus on the monoline insurance companies, AmBec, and
next
and
question.
Okay.
But AIG was, that Lehman weekend, I mean, AIG was on the table in a sense. I saw documents indicating there was a working group meeting on AIG that same weekend. So, you know, can you tell us a little bit about, maybe you can't tell us because you didn't work on it, but to what extent was there a feeling that, you know, that AIG is not far from needing a pretty radical solution at that point?
These aren't the right people to answer. Okay. So, I mean, there are people who can answer that, but they're not the right
people. And my second follow-up was, you mentioned that you were doing a number of things at the four iBanks that you were on site in the April through September time period to improve the stability of those firms. What were you doing? Were you asking them to do certain things, to sell positions, to raise capital? I mean, can you tell me more precisely what you were doing other than you were doing things?
Oh, sure.
I don't mean to. I just.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Again, it started with liquidity, understanding their liquidity positions, and be able to make an assessment of their liquidity from a baseline perspective, and also so we'd know if they came under stress, whether that was stressful or not. So one of the first things was to set up a framework for analyzing their liquidity, and again, to prevent them from getting complacent, getting lazy, knowing that the PDCF was behind them, came up with this analysis and called them in several times over the course of the spring and said, this is what our analysis shows. So we told at least two of the firms, Merrill Lynch and Lehman, you ought to go out and strengthen and improve your liquidity position by X billion dollars. Please go away and tell us how you're going to do that and report back to us. So that was clearly one of our main focuses. With respect to Lehman, the other things that were happening, which were more of at a higher level, were the constant conversations or the frequent conversations between folks like Secretary Paulson, folks like Tim, and even several of our meetings here with the firm were, what are you doing in terms of other solutions? So, again, asset sales they were thinking about. They were delving with the Koreans. They talked about Neuberger Berman. But it wasn't up for us to say, do X rather than Y. It was, yeah, guys need to make a decision. Tell us when you're going to tell us, you know, what your options are and where you are in that progress. So those conversations were probably more at a higher, they were more at a higher level than the folks we had monitoring.
When did you approximately ask Lehman and Merrill to increase their liquidity?
I know we had several scenario analyses we ran. It probably would have been July, early July.
Do you remember how much you asked them each respectively to increase?
20 and 15, I think. I don't recall which one was
which. 20 and 15 would go which?
I think it was
We can get back to that.
Okay. You've got the documents.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Perfect. And then we have to show the response as well.
I think there's, yeah, that, yes, your email traffic on the response.
Looking at the Wachovia City assisted transaction, the documents make pretty clearly that you have sort of a divided view about it. In other words, one was that having all those core deposits would actually help City's liquidity position and help City. On the other hand, there were some concentrations of risks and potential risk spillovers. To what extent did you feel that, you know, putting City and Wachovia together would be a pretty serious, you know, supervisory challenge, and you know, maybe even had some sense of, if not misgivings, at least, you know, concerns about that.
Well, let me just maybe back up a step. I mean, clearly, City had its own vulnerabilities. It was then a three-rated firm, and it had liquidity that was an ongoing challenge. I mean, it was not losing a lot of its funding, but the term structure of the funding was such that it was vulnerable in the event of a problem. And on the capital side, again, its capital position was pretty good. It looked at by normal ratios, but its vulnerability and distress would certainly be there. What we saw in the Wachovia deal, particularly if it were an assisted deal where there is downside protection from the FDIC as part of the equation, is that they would get a lot more of the first element that you talked about than suffer on the second, that their deposit-taking franchise in the U.S. was smaller, certainly relative to the whole, than most of the other major firms, and being able to expand the deposit-taking franchise down through the South and develop a whole lot more core deposits, which are traditionally stickier than other sources of funding, including foreign deposits, was a distinct positive from our vantage point. We also saw that if the transaction is appropriately structured so that the capital would not be adversely hit and there would be downside protection and there would be a capability to go to the market and maybe raise more capital, and our my experience is that when you go to the marketplace, particularly in a tough time for raising equity, if there's some real clear plan that the market can attach weight to, you have a whole lot better chance to raise a good slug of capital than if you're saying, I'm out here because I need it. So having a Wachovia-assisted deal, right, we saw as having the potential to be positive, not only on the liquidity side, but on the capital side. And if the asset quality protections were appropriately in place, we viewed it as a real possibility for approval. I mean, obviously, we never got to the point of approving it, but it wasn't bad faith to have let Citi go as far down the path as we did without a sense that there could be a structure between the capital side and the degree of protection that will lead us to favorable action on.
Let me, I see the time, so let me at least ask this one last question. And again, it's on the whole issue too big to fail, and it's more a generalized question. And that is, you know, another thing we've done is we've looked back in, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s on institutions that that got bailed out, that were considered systemically important. And, you know, when we look at those institutions, they all sort of follow the same pattern, right? I mean, leverage growth, short-term funding sources, high-risk assets, and when the asset values became a concern, you know, there was issues and you had to bail them out. But even those institutions, you know, weren't, you know, several hundred billion dollar institutions or trillion dollar institutions, and yet, you know, so you look back at that and you see, okay, they all follow the same pattern, and then we see in the decade of the 2000s, we saw the same thing but on a much larger scale. And this sort of goes to what I asked you in the very beginning. You know, and I don't know the answer, but I'm asking all people that I'm talking to this is, what do we do? I mean, you know, when you know that fact pattern is what leads to systemically important institutions that you can't let fail, but at the same time you got a free market economy, you know, what are the bank supervisors doing? What are you guys doing here at the New York Fed, especially since you've got the big boys? You know, about these systemically
impacted.
Right.
A bunch of them.
Right.
Yeah. And it's an absolutely fair question. I would say at the outset, and I'm sure you would agree, that we did not see anything during the 70s, 80s, or 90s that even comes close to approximating what the situation was in the 2007 to early 2009 period. The intensity of the problems that swept across the marketplace and made it extraordinarily difficult for firms with particular business models, some of whose elements, Chris, you ticked off as you were describing it. If firms, the way in which they took their liabilities and the way in which they created their exposures was such as to make them vulnerable, they would be more likely to have a problem. It's only all the investment banks fall neatly into that category. I think as we try to take lessons learned from everything that happened in the run-up to the crisis as well as during the crisis, I think there are a lot of things in terms of risk management and approaches to within the firm that firms have had to learn. And we did a lot of work that we chaired a group called the Senior Supervisors Group that's done a lot of work around risk management practices and what tended to lead some firms to do better going through the crisis than others. But I think as supervisors, we've also had to take a very critical look at some of our internal processes and ask whether we had a clear enough understanding of the changing market environment in order to make assessments of individual firms. I often quote something that the head of the UKFSA, Adair Turner, said, and you probably have seen the quote too, and it's just the marvelous English turn of phrase, whatever you think about the judgments within it. And basically what he said was, the failure of Northern Rock was much less a failure of micro-supervision and much more a failure to connect the dots between some broad macro trends. And in my head, that has resonated, that you look at all of the major firms that had problems throughout the crisis. What we have been doing within the New York Fed, going back several years, and I think system-wide we're making great progress on doing this in a broader way, is to try to get a better, more consistent perspective on where vulnerabilities are developing at the macro level or the financial sector level. I think we need that kind of overarching understanding of where is the next source of problems, what's the degree of stress that firms have to be prepared to deal with, and then we as micro supervisors have to take from all that richer understanding and apply appropriate regimes to the individual firms, including things around stress testing. We've done, I think, a fair bit of work around stress testing. I think we have learned we didn't do as much as we should have done in stress testing. And some of it goes to what was kind of implicit in your question, Chris. What were our expectations for firms as they were carrying out stress tests? Was it things that were idiosyncratic to the particular firm, or was it to recognize a more systemic source of problems that the firm would have to deal with? We were clearly much more tilted to the former than the latter. During the crisis, the latter was a huge component of the overall issue. What's the dimension of the problem that could even be considered by the firm in fashioning the stress test? You go back a few years, firms fashioned their stress tests to see what would happen, what could happen where they could lose up to a quarter's worth of earnings. And that was considered a pretty daunting stress test 4 or 5 years ago. Throughout the crisis, I think people learned there could be even greater downside risk than that. And the supervisors need to explore the extent to which the firms have vulnerabilities in the extreme to extreme disturbances and be prepared to take actions on the basis of the potential for that to be realized. So we've, I think, learned to do a lot more and to be more exacting in our stress test expectations, and we've learned, I think, to try to get the context much, much clearer.
I just have one follow-up question, you know, which I think follows from what you said, which is, has the Fed, either by itself or in conjunction with other agencies, done postmortems or lessons learned on Lehman, on Citi, on Wachovia? Because I could imagine, you know, doing sort of looking back exercises and saying, well, knowing what we know now, we might have handled this differently. I don't know if you've done formal, you know, written exercises on those three firms, among others.
We have done formal written exercises on the overall subject, taking into consideration a subset of the firms you just alluded to.
Right.
We're particularly focused on the firms that we supervise. So we did an extensive lessons learned exercise that the outgoing vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, Don Cohn, led, that explored the lessons learned from the oversight of a bunch of major firms, less looking at the facts of each firm and more looking at what does that mean for the overall approaches to supervision.
Thank you.
We're out of time.
You're even out of time.
Thank you all for your
time. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.